Yeah, assume that you're all very happy that now I posted the first homework. So it will be due on the 10th. And then I just made a minor change to the exam date because I'll be traveling on the 17th. So if you have the exam on the 16th, I'll be here to proctor the exam. And hopefully I'll return the exams the next day, the 17th, before I take off. And we'll have the review for the exam on the 15th, so the day before the exam. And the review as well as the exam, they will be conducted outside the regular meeting times from 5 to 7. And then I will post the rooms as and when I go. So I'll find two rooms for the 2 weeks.
Will we be having a practice exam?
Yeah, I'll post a model exam anytime now.
Okay.
And the solutions to the model exam. And I will also post a one-page help sheet, which I will bring copies to the exam. You don't have to bring copies, but you can take a look at the help sheet and see what would be in the help sheet. And the help sheet also will be a brief summary of the syllabus for the exam. So in that sense, the help sheet also. Okay, so any other questions? Okay. Exams as well as the reviews will be from 5 to 7 p.m. I will find larger rooms and then I will announce the rooms. So any objections to any of these arrangements? I'm sorry. Another time, yeah, sure. No. So if you cannot make it, we can make special arrangements. So any other questions or comments? So if not, let's continue with our discussion. So we have been talking about the idea of fingerprinting. So in particular, last time we looked at three examples of fingerprinting where the first problem was given three matrices, A, B, and C, we wanted to check if AB equals C. That's one example. And the second example was given three polynomials, F, G, and H, F and G having degree N, and H having degree 2N. The problem was to check if F, G equals H. So that was the second example. Third example was given a multivariate polynomial. We wanted to check if this polynomial is identically equal to 0. So these were the three problems wherein we were able to apply the fingerprinting idea to speed up the time complexities, to do faster than the trivial or the obvious algorithms. But of course, we showed that we can solve these with a very high probability, meaning that we can produce an answer which will be correct with a very high probability. Within time, that will be much better than using this straightforward algorithms. So we'll continue with the same theme today. We will talk about the problem of pattern matching. So this is a problem that comes about quite a bit in many different areas, particularly in bioinformatics. So the string matching problem is kind of quite widely used. Whatever the problem could be, it could be as simple as finding similarities between sequences, or it could be building a phylogeny tree. So there are so many places where string matching plays an important role. It also plays, an important role in text editing. It's another example. So before we talk about the string matching, so there is a related problem wherein, let's say we are given given two sequences of bits. Each sequence has n bits, ordered sequence. And we want to check if these two sequences are the same or not. So that's one problem. So input will be two, as I said, sequences, so say A1, A2, A3, BN, and B equals B1, B2, BN. And this is an ordered sequence. And I would like to check if A equals B or not. Problem outcome is Yes, if A equals B. No. Of course, we can solve this in linear time, linear in N. But here is another fingerprinting approach to tackle this problem. Now, if there are bits, so I just said that each AI is either 0 or 1, and BJ is either 0 or 1, for all I A. So they're all binary sequences. So I can compare one at a time, one bit at a time, and then I'll be, that's a trivial thing. So what we can do is to use the fingerprinting as follows. Namely, I can think of A as an n-bit integer, and B also as an n-bit integer. Then use the following idea. So let's call the integer as select qb equal to summation. We can think of this as the least significant bit, and then go that way, or we can do it the other way. So either one is fine. Let's do it from that one. So let's say I have ai 2 to the I, and I running from 0 to so in this case, I want to say I running from 0 to n minus 1. So that means I want to say ai plus 1. Right. So that will make it. This is a list LSB and so on. And then likewise, I can also think of this one as an integer. Say I n from 0 to n minus 1 of b I plus 1 to I. So I have two n-bit integers, and then I want to check if these two are the same. Now, here is an idea, namely, I would like to pick a random prime number. Right? So pick a random prime number. Prime number in some range, let's say, less than or equal to, say, some capital T, small t. We'll fix the value of t in a minute. That value of t will be fixed by our requirement that the probability of an incorrect answer be very small, right? That is always our kind of a constraint, which also will enable us to fix some of the parameters that are involved in the algorithm. So I'm going to pick a random prime number less than or equal to t, and then check the following. So if I call the prime number as say a small p or something, so if q mod p equals R mod P, then output S, else output. So that we are just taking the modulus, right? I mean, here by this I mean, you divide Q by P, and then the remainder is what you call as say Q mod P, right? Remainder that is strictly less than P. So that is what we call as the modulus. Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we think of these as the least significant bit and the next least significant bit and so on. Okay. So we think of it as a binary.
If the size of the prime number is, we continue to make it smaller, then the
probability should be yeah, in other words, as we see in the analysis, the larger the t, the better will be the problem. I mean, lower will be the probability for an incorrect answer. Yeah, so it'll become clear in the analysis, right? We'll do it in a minute. So I want t to be as large as possible, or I want it to be larger and larger for me to have a better and better probability of success.
Is there a reason why we pick a prime number?
Yeah, there is a reason.
Okay.
That will enable us to analyze the algorithm nicely.
Okay.
But if p is smaller, then like P was 3, then the modulus should only mean a 0, 1, 2. So the remainder should like match when the numbers are exactly equal.
See, the problem with having a smaller P, for example, if my P is say 2, then the remainder is either 0 or 1.
Yes.
So I may not be able to accurately predict if A is equal to P. So yeah, that is kind of the danger. So because we are kind of rapidly collapsing the numbers into either 0 or 1. Okay, so any other questions? So why does it work? And what should be the value of T, right? That's the more important question. Okay, so let's call this as S as Q minus R. So we are just basically asking, what is S equal to 0 or not, right? So that's what we are asking. And another way of asking the same thing is, we are asking, what is the probability that S mod P equals 0, given that R is not equal to S, or Q is not equal to S. Right, so this is the same thing. So if Q is equal to R, we will never give an incorrect answer, right? Whatever prime I pick, this will always be satisfied. So therefore, again, it's a one-sided error. Therefore, we only worry about the case when Q is not equal to R, but my S mod P equal to 0, right? What is the probability of that happening? So S mod P equal to 0 means that the prime number P divides the number S, right? Yeah. So it's the same as probability that P divides S, given that Q is not equal. Now, since Q and R are n-bit integers, one question is, how many prime divisors are there for the number S, for example? So number of prime divisors. For S is less than or equal to, we want to say it is less than or equal to something. Now, if Q is an n-bit integer and R is an n-bit integer, then Q minus R is going to be an n-bit integer, right? So meaning that the maximum value that the integer can take is 2 to the n minus 1, right? That's the maximum value it can take. Therefore, we are asking how many distinct prime divisors can this number S have? We know that every prime number is at least 2, therefore, the maximum number of prime divisors, distinct prime divisors that S can have is no more than n, right? Because
you knew exactly that you were famous
for. Right, again, yeah, sure. So we know that it is at most n, right? So that we know. Is that agreed? Because we know that S is no more than 2 to the n, therefore the number of prime divisors for that is no more than n. So it's less than or equal to n, because we know that each prime number is at least 2. So that is one fact.
Raj.
Yeah.
I don't understand. If it's 2 to the n, how does it follow that's less than or equal to n?
Because the number of prime divisors, it can be distinct prime divisors. It can either be 2, 3, 5, 7, and so on.
Right.
So it means that if I multiply these out, that should be equal to no more than 2 to the power n. So how many such prime numbers can I think of whose product is no more than 2 to the n? And knowing that every one of those prime numbers is at least 2, right? So therefore, I can have at most n of those prime divisors, such that if I multiply all of them up, it will be 2 to the power m or less.
That it has to be 2 to the power of n?
Because we know that both q and r are n-bit integers, therefore the value of each one of them is no more than 2 to the n.
Right.
And therefore q minus r also is no more than 2 to the power n.
Okay.
So then we look at the prime divisors for the number s.
Mm.
And then, so we can write s as, you know, for example, p1 to the power e1, p2 to the power e2, maybe pk to the power ek. So these are the, you know, factors of the integer s.
Mm-hmm.
And we are asking how many k's are there whose product will be equal to s. We know that s is no more than 2 to the power n.
Okay.
So the maximum value of k occurs when all of those exponents, e1 through ek, are 1.
Uh-huh.
Right? So, and we also know that each of these prime numbers is no more than 2. Sorry, no less than 2. So that means that k can be at most n.
Okay. Those exponents can either be 0 or 1, right?
1 or more.
Oh, okay.
Right? Because if it is 0, we don't care about it. It's not a factor.
Uh-huh.
It's not a prime factor. So it has to be at least 1.
And so why are you setting all of the exponents to 1 in that case?
That is what will give me the maximum value for k. For example, if it could be the case that s equals p1 to the power e1. There is only one prime, distinct prime factor. In which case, k equals 1.
Oh, I see.
Right?
Thank you.
If I want to increase the value of k, then I better have e1s as, eis as 1s.
I see. Thank you.
Right. So the number of prime divisors for s is no more than n. Why are we caring about this? Because if I pick a random prime number, if that prime number happens to be one of the divisors of the number s, then I will get a 0. Right? I don't want that to happen. So I pick a random prime number in that range. If the number I pick happens to be one of those prime divisors, then I'm going to give an incorrect answer because that number will divide my s. So I'm looking for a number, prime number, which is not a prime divisor, so that my answer will be correct. Right? So I'm going to give an incorrect answer if and only if the prime number I pick happens to be one of the prime divisors. From order of how many prime numbers, right? We are picking a prime number in the range 2, t, right? So another question is, so within that range, how many prime numbers are there, right? That's the question that we have to ask. So how many prime numbers are there in between 2 and t, or less than or equal to t? In fact, this is the problem that so many people have studied and still study to see the density of prime numbers in the integer line, right?
I heard there was a mathematical problem that was related to, I forget which one though, like the unsolved one.
Calculating the density exactly is still an unsolved problem, but people are coming closer and closer. So, for example, you know, a great mathematicians like Ramanujan has been studying this problem for quite some time, and he came up with a formula that is very, very close to the actual density. Right? So here is the known fact. Number of prime numbers less than or equal to t happens to be theta of t divided by log of t. So the challenge is, so this is very well understood, but the challenge is what is a constant, right? So that's why, you know, there is so much of, so many number theorists are, concentrating on this problem to make it.
They claim that Riemann hypothesis has been solved by Professor Michael Appiah. It's a recent claim that he has solved the Riemann hypothesis problem. So if that problem is solved, this should have been solved.
Now, if the Riemann hypothesis, I'm not sure if, you know, that has been settled, because, you know, in the literature on, in general, mathematics or, you know, algorithms, like for instance, P equals NP, right? There have been at least hundreds of papers written where somebody will claim that, you know, they have a proof that, you know, P equals NP, and then somebody else will find a bug in the proof and so on.
Recently, last Monday, we announced that.
So, you know, even if that is true, I don't know if it will directly imply that the density is exactly known as a closed form formula, right? You're right, the Riemann's hypothesis is closely related to questions of this kind. But then, you know, it's not clear how that will settle this question forever. So that is a question. It's not very clear. But what is very well understood is this fact, namely that it is asymptotically, or theta, right? Both lower and upper bounded by constant multiples of t divided by log t. So which basically says that, roughly speaking, the density is 1 over log n. So if you give me t, if you look at integers up to t, then there are t over log t prime numbers in that integer. So that is the good news for us. Then we can go ahead and say, okay, what should be the value of t so that my probability of an incorrect answer is low. Right? So I have these many prime numbers. From out of those are the dangerous ones, namely at most n of them are dangerous. So what is the probability then I give an incorrect answer? The answer is t divided by the total number of prime numbers I have access to, right? Which is the t divided by log of t. So that is our probability of an incorrect answer. So this implies that probability of an incorrect answer. T is less than or equal to n divided by t divided by log. So I'm just assuming the constant is 1. You know, you can just throw a constant, but it's not going to make the analysis different.
T divided by log of t.
Since I put the theta over here, I think the log is to the base e, but I'm, you know, since I'm putting the theta, I'm not even worried about the base. So here again, I'm just saying log of t, you know, without worrying about the constant.
N or k?
I'm sorry?
N is the number of the maximum number of primes that. Prime
divisors, yeah.
You said
that's
k.
So, this is n, right?
Yeah, but I mean, you said that there is k. Right?
Yeah, so it's n divided by t over log t. Right? That's the probability. So we want this probability to be no more than n to the minus alpha, right? And then again, then the question is, what should be the value of t? So that's a trivial thing, right? So this will be less than or equal to e to the minus alpha, for example, like if I pick t to be greater than or equal to, so some 2 times e to the alpha plus 1 log of e to the alpha plus 1. Yes, it's a trivial matter. Like, I want this to be no more than e to the minus alpha. What is the value? So this is basically, n to the alpha plus 1, some constant times n to the alpha plus 1 times log of n to the alpha plus 1.
I couldn't quite hear you. You were saying something about the inequality?
Yeah, I want this to be no more than n to the minus alpha.
Yeah, and then what were you saying about t greater than equal?
Yeah, if I pick this to be at least that, then this will be satisfied. And what I was saying was that this constant could be 2 or 3 or whatever. You can choose that.
And how did we get was that just algebra too?
Yeah, just algebra.
Okay.
So I just have to, for this value of t, substitute here and then simplify this. It will turn out to be no more than 2 minutes. Yeah, like a simple algebra. So that is the kind of basic idea using fingerprinting. Okay. If S is a prime number, that's not a problem because there is only one prime divisor for that number. Again, so it's going to only improve my probability. So meaning that k equals 1, the number of prime divisors that we're talking about. I think you know, I think the KO is referring to the general example then. Yeah. So. What is the runtime? Yeah, that's a good question actually. Are we doing some kind of a cheating or something, right? That's what you're asking. So
picking a random prime.
Yes. Yeah. We are assuming that that takes, I guess, a small amount of time. But you're right. Finding a random prime number is not a trivial task. But what people do in practice is, you know, there is a kind of a library of known prime numbers. For example, Springer, they publish books periodically wherein they list all the prime the largest prime numbers known up to that time. And it's like every time it becomes a larger, larger book. So if I assume that I have stored them in my memory, in my computer, then it is just a matter of picking one of them. Mm-hmm. So if I have that list, then this is probably doable. In other words, I'm not going to go and test, you know, generate a prime number at that time. Just use random numbers.
You were mentioning that algorithm as like, okay, how are you going to actually make this faster than just doing it linear time if you're trying to find prime numbers and stuff?
Okay, yeah, that's where, you know, picking a random prime number in this context would be assumed to be, to take only 1 unit of time. So I have a list of the known prime numbers. In particular, up to my T. So then I pick one of them. I flip my coin. You're right. I mean, if from a practical perspective, that's what I will do. But from a theoretical perspective, I assume that I can find one such prime number in answer.
And just confirm T that would be some arbitrarily large prime number.
Exactly right. So in fact, as we have done in the analysis, we are saying that we will pick a prime number that is in the range 2, comma this number, you know, uniformly randomly. Okay.
So what's the runtime of modulus?
Oh, okay. So, in fact, it is doable in constant time. For example, if you use Java or C++, they support this operation in constant time.
Just two quick questions. Why are we starting from 2 in the interval? Why is it 2 to t?
Because it does not have to be 2 comma t. If I have access to a large number of prime numbers, I'm just going to pick one of them randomly. That's what it is.
Oh, up to t.
Yeah.
Okay. And why is it dangerous for us to choose
pick one of the prime devices?
Yeah.
Because that will give me an incorrect answer.
How?
Because if I have a prime divisor, then T is going to divide S, meaning that this will be satisfied. Even if Q is not equal to R, if the P that I pick happens to be a divisor of S, I will get 0, which is an incorrect answer.
I see. Thank you.
So therefore, we won't avoid those prime divisors. And then if our collection of prime numbers is large, then the probability we pick one such prime divisor is low. That's good. Okay, so any other questions?
What's the advantage of thinking of time? Like, you know, it has no divisor itself, so we don't care if who has a divisor.
Yeah, sorry, what?
Like, what's the advantage of picking a prime rather than just a number?
An integer, okay. Then, you know, an analysis of this kind may not be trivial because the number you have, you are going to pick may have multiple divisors, then how do you deal with that analysis? That's the only part. But other than that, you know, there is nothing
that
prevents us.
Whether or not P has a divisor, we're trying to see whether or not P is a divisor.
Right. So, yeah, it can work with any integer. For example, I may want to ask the question, what is the probability that the number that I pick has no common divisor with S?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Then again, it should work. So if I can do that analysis, that will be great as well. So in this case, you know, picking the prime numbers helps us very quickly do the analysis, knowing something about the density of the prime numbers on the interval. That's only reason. Okay, so any other questions or comments? No, okay. Let's move on to the string matching problem and then see how this can be applied in that. So in some sense, you know, we will see that this is going to be utilized in the string matching quite nicely. So let's see how we are going to do that. So we have done the analysis. So. This was the algorithm proposed by Karp and Rabin and Karp. And by the both of them got Turing Awards at some point or the other. So Karp Rabin's algorithm, randomized algorithm, for string matching. So I'll see what the string matching is. So my input is a text, a long text. And so this is from some alphabet, you know, sigma. And I'm also given a path, P1, P2, Pn. Again from the same alphabet. And I want output.
Also, I'm just curious about something that since we're on the top of the randomized algorithms.
Right.
What is the actual runtime for picking something random? Because I know that, like, it's really hard to access randomness.
Oh yeah, that's a good question also. What do we mean by, in other words, is there anything like a truly random number, right? That's a philosophical question. And one can spend their lifetimes talking about, you know, whether there is anything truly random. But the good news is that even if I use a very stupid pseudo-random number generator, in practice, it seems to work nicely. In fact, all the implementations they are just going to use, you know, for example, in Java or C++, they have this many kinds of random functions. Typically, it's going to generate a random number uniformly distributed in the range 0, 1. Then I can convert it to integers or whatever I want. And that is good enough for, you know, practical purposes. But yeah, there is a whole lot of literature on, you know, minimizing the number of random bits in many different algorithms, you know, that kind of a thing. So I guess we don't worry too much. We just assume that we can generate, or we can flip an n-sided coin in 1 unit of time. So that is kind of simple assumption. So I want to report all the places where the pattern occurs in the text. That's what the problem is. So all I is such that Ti, Ti+1, Ti+n-1 equals t. So all the places where the pattern occurs in the text. And as I said, this problem is so widely applicable in many different domains, including bioinformatics, quite widely used. And of course, the trivial algorithm would be just sliding the pattern in the text every time spending m time. That would be a total of m n. That's a trivial algorithm. So, a trivial algorithm. Big of time. And there are many linear time algorithms. One very well known algorithm is the KMP algorithm, Knuth, Morris, and Pratt. So they probably this is the first one they showed that this can be solved in linear time. Sure. There are many such linear time algorithms. This can be solved in big of n. Perhaps one of the simplest linear time algorithms, deterministic worst case linear time algorithms, could be to use a proper data structure like a suffix tree or a suffix array. So if you once, so it is known that we can construct a suffix tree in linear time. So once you construct the suffix tree, then looking for the pattern is a trivial thing. So you can just do it in one, you know, walk through the tree. Equivalently, I can, if I have a suffix array, then I can do the same.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand the output. What are we doing with T?
So as an example, for example, so let's say I have the text is A, B, A, A, B, A, 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 and my pattern happens to be, let's say, A, B, A, let's say A, A, B. I'm supposed to report where are the places in the text that, where I can find this thing. Right? There is an occurrence starting from this point. So one of the I values will be equal to 3. Like if I count from here, 1, 2, 3. And then there is another one, A, A, B. So that will be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So the answers here will be. So there's one occurrence starting from position 3, another one 4, 5, 6, 7, and then there's another one, so 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, so those are the occurrences of the pattern. So I'm going to report the starting points where I can see the occurrence. No.
Wait, just if the 2, 6, and 10 concerns starting at 0? Oh, wait, start with 1.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a convention. I assume that this is 1. Yeah, I just call it as 1, but, you know, for practical purposes, I guess 0 will make sense. If you have an array, then that would. Okay, so how does the part Raven? So assume that the alphabet is binary. Assume that sigma equals 0, 1. Then let's also define the following. Let capital T sub I be defined as the substring starting from I, Ti plus 1, Ti plus and minus 1. So then we can think of this as an m-bit integer, right? So naturally, because I have a binary sequence of length m, therefore I can think of it as an m-bit integer. And the pattern also has m bits in it, therefore it is also an m-bit integer. So the algorithm is the following, namely, for I equal to 1, 2, n minus m plus 1, pick a random prime t less than or equal to t. We will fix the value of t in the analysis. If t sub I mod p equals p mod p, then output I, and that's the algorithm. Right. So now, from a practical perspective, what they suggested was to pick the value of m so that would be the size of your word size of your computer. Right? We always. For example, if I have a 32-bit machine or a 64-bit machine, so then if I have a 64-bit machine, I'll choose M to be 64, so that this operation can be done in one unit of time, the modulus operation. So that's kind of the practical perspective. Now, there are two things we have to worry about, namely, how much time does it take, and what is the probability of an incorrect answer, right? So these are the two things.
What's your answer?
Yeah.
What why is it n minus m plus 1?
Because there are only those many. Oh, yeah. So, for example, I only want to capture the m characters starting from position I.
Okay.
Right, and these are the m characters. Starting from I, ending up at I plus m minus 1.
The
ramp
is
going to
be n minus n plus 1 times m.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Which is a big of m. So we want to simplify that.
And then you plus 1?
Yeah, because if I count how many characters are here, that will be equal to m, right? So I have m characters in total.
Oh, got it. And then the upper index, I plus m minus 1?
Yeah.
How do you know the output goes up to that index?
Because I'm only, because I know the size of the pattern is m.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, I only look for a substring of length m and check if it is equal to the pattern.
Okay.
Right, so I want to check if there is an occurrence starting from position I.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I look at the starting from I, I look at m characters.
Yeah.
And check if those m characters will be the same as the pattern.
I see.
Right, so that's what I want to check. Okay, so the algorithm readily follows from what we did in the other, you know, example of two integers. Now let's do a couple of analyses, namely the time analysis as well as the probability analysis. Probability of incorrectness. Okay, so for one particular, if I fix the value of I, so for specific I, probability of an incorrect answer is going to be less than or equal to. So we are talking about an m bit integer, therefore the total number of prime devices is no more than m. So therefore the numerator is going to be m, and the denominator we know is t divided by log of t, right? Because of the prime number there. So what is the probability that there is at least one I in which I give an incorrect answer, right? So let's ask that question. So this means that probability of an incorrect answer for at least one I, that is less than or equal to. We can use the fundamental fact from probabilities, namely probability of A union B is no more than probability of A plus probability of B. So if I use that fact, then this is no more than n minus m plus 1 times that problem that we have. Which in turn is less than or equal to, if I just get rid of the m, then I have mn divided by log of t over log. And as usual, I want this probability to be no more than n to the minus alpha, then I'll fix my value t. So if we choose t to be greater than or equal to, again I'm throwing an arbitrary constant 2 here, m times n to the alpha plus 1 times log of m n to the alpha plus 1. Then the above probability. So we know how to choose the value of t. So that our probability of giving an incorrect answer for any position, right? So we're talking about all the positions that we will never give an incorrect answer, and that probability is at least 1 minus n to the minus 1. Our probability of giving an incorrect answer is no more than n to the minus 1. Okay, so any questions on that? Now, how about the time that we are going to spend? Right? So let's calculate the runtime. Okay, so I have t sub i is an integer, as we said. So let's see what an integer is. So t sub I is nothing but, if I think of that as an integer, where, you know, as like a convention, as we can say that I, let's say this is the least significant bit, and this is the most significant bit, then I can write this as 2 to the m minus 1 t sub I plus 2 to the m minus 2 t sub I plus 1 plus 2 times t I plus m minus 2 plus t of I plus m minus 1. Right? That is our t sub I as an integer. And that's the integer we are going to use to take the mod, right? So when we say t I mod p, we are talking about that integer over there. That's a m-bit integer. Is that agreed? So we just use the definition of the binary. And how about t I plus 1? Let's see what that is. T I plus 1. 2 to the m minus 1, as you show. And this starts with t I plus 1. Plus 2 to the m minus 2 t I plus 2, and then here we have 2 times t of I plus m minus 1 plus t of I plus m. Right, so we just wrote down what they are, t I and t I plus 1. Let's multiply this by 2 and see what happens. 2 times t sub I is equal to 2 to the m times t sub I plus 2 to the n minus 1 t I plus 1 plus 2 to the n minus 2 t I plus 2. And finally we will have 2 times t I plus n minus 1 plus t I plus basically up to that. 2 times t of I plus n. So let's call this as equation 1. And let's see what we get when we subtract this from that. So when I subtract 2 from 1,
Dr. What's the last term?
The last term is 2 times this guy. Right, that's 2 times t I plus m minus 1.
I see.
And the first one is 2 to the m t I, and so on. So that's all. So then we subtract 2 from 1. So 1 minus 2. T I plus 1 minus T sub I equals, so let's take the blue one. So when we subtract this from that, we are going to have, so this is
2 to the n minus 1 t I plus 1. So that will be canceled. And the next one will be canceled. 2 I plus n minus 1 will be canceled. So then we'll be left with this and that. So that will be. Minus 2 to the n dr. T sub. Which means that T I plus 1 equals T sub I plus T I plus n minus 2 to the n T sub I. So when we subtracted 2 to the n t sub I, that means, yeah, we are subtracting 2 from 1, right? So that means t of I plus 1 minus t sub I will be?
2 times t.
Oh, 2 times t sub I. Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot that. Oh, you are right, yeah. Oh, yeah, you are right, yeah. Absolutely. 2 times t sub I, and then this one is fine. So what does this mean? It means that we can, at the very beginning, compute all the powers of 2, right? I mean, in this case, I only need 2 to the power m anyway. So I do that only once and keep it ready, because that is going to be repeatedly used. So if you give me t sub I, then I can calculate t sub I plus 1 in constant time, right? Because if you give me t sub I, then I have to multiply that with 2, add this, and then multiply these two, and then subtract, right? So it's going to cost me only constant time. So this means that t I plus 1 can be computed in an additional constant time given capital C T sub I for of course 1 less than or equal to I less than or equal to, say I plus n minus n plus n. You can even say n minus m. Because the last one is n minus m plus 1. Right, so that is the good news, namely that we can compute one entry given the previous entry in an additional constant. Of course, for the first one, we have to spend m time. That's negligible. I mean, not negligible in the sense. The total time we spend is going to be proportional to n minus m, some constant times that, plus m, which is going to give us the big of n. Or if you want to call it as m plus n, that is fine. That's big of n. I'm sorry.
So still basically
linear time in n. The total will be linear. So this implies that the
other thing could have been computed in linear time as well? Like with term distance?
What are you going to compute in the first place? The string matching?
Yes.
That's where the KMP algorithm works. Lose more stuff. So the way the KMP algorithm works is it's going to take the pattern and do some pre-processing on it. In fact, when they wrote the algorithm, they used a PDA to do that. So what it does is it's going to enable us, for example, if I use the trivial algorithm wherein I slide the pattern one position at a time, so when I come to a position where I, let's say, do not find a match, the trivial algorithm will move to the next position, whereas the pre-processing will dictate us or tell us that you can jump to a certain position because in between you will not possibly find a match, right? That's the kind of information they gather in the pre-processing, and that enables us to make a
whenever there is a match or a mismatch, they can jump a certain amount of positions. So in the totally they spend many time. On the pre-processing, at least the original paper, they took m square time for the pre-processing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, people normally do not worry too much about the pre-processing, assuming that that's generally only once, and then after that, the text is going to change. Therefore, you're not going to repeat the, keeping the pattern the same, in which case you can ignore the pre-processing. Right? That's kind of the rationale. Okay, so that is the string matching algorithm. So yeah, I just wanted to conclude by saying that the total runtime is. Now, clearly the way we have described the algorithm, it is a Monte Carlo algorithm. Right. So I just, if there is a match in the modulus, I just say yes. But we can also convert it to a Las Vegas algorithm as follows, namely, whenever there is a hit, where hit means that the two moduli are the same, I can go ahead and do an exact checking in that in those positions. Right? Then it will become a Las Vegas algorithm. So we can convert this to the Las Vegas algorithm. The idea is, so whenever there is a hit, whenever, let me say what it is, whenever Ti mod P equals P mod P, check if T sub I equals P. Meaning that you spend the M comparisons. As we can see, in the worst case, if the number of matches is very small, then this is a very nice Las Vegas algorithm. But if I have a extreme case where there are too many matches, then this is going to, in the worst case, take big of M and I. Right? No better than that again. So that concludes our discussion on, at least for now, randomness algorithms. Of course, we will revisit them and we talk about like you know, parallel algorithms and so on. Now, before our next topic will be polynomial arithmetic. Now, before we go there, I just want to talk a little bit about some of the inequalities you will need for your homework problems. Especially problem number two. I don't know how many of you have looked at the homework yet. I know at least some of you have done it because my today's office hours, there were people who came and asked questions. For some of you, it may be news that I have posted the homework. But in general, please feel free to ask me questions if you have any problems with the homework, either through email or if you come to my office hours. But in the future classes, I will also give some hints for different problems. And this is what I wanted to say about that. Inequalities. So perhaps one of the very well-known inequalities is the Markov's inequality. The Markov's inequality says the following, that x be any non-negative random variable with a mean of mu, and the inequality says that probability that x is greater than or equal to a times mu is less than or equal to 1 over a, of course a be for any a, is a greater than 0. We are not interested in a being. I think that's a very cute proof of this. So we'll just take a couple of minutes to do this. So let's define this f of x. Let f of x be defined as 1 if x is greater than or equal to a times mu, and zero otherwise. So then we note that then f of x is less than or equal to a x divided by a. Right? So, any questions?
Oh no, I was just saying on this one.
Okay, sorry. So, then it's very clear that f of x is less than or equal to x divided by a mu, right? Because if x is less than a mu, we know that this is equal to zero. And if x is greater than a mu, that means this is greater than or equal to one. So that is, okay.
If it turns out that p will lend p, then pseudo random generators wouldn't actually exist. Would that matter for the purposes of this, of like this sort of thing, like fingerprinting or these randomized algorithms? Would it just matter for cryptography?
Yeah, probably it matters for the cryptography more than for algorithmic domain, because people are already using the pseudo random generators faithfully and truthfully, right? Because all of these algorithms people have devised have been implemented in practice, and they do beat the other algorithms convincingly. So therefore, what happens on the P equals NP domain is not going to affect the existing program. So that's good news. So we have that. We make the following observation, namely, expected value of f of x, right, according to the definition. So it is going to be either 1, and the probability will be probability that x is greater than or equal to a mu, plus 0 times probability x is less than a mu. So which is the same as probability that x is greater than a mu. Now from equation 1, we know that expected value of f of x is less than or equal to expected value of x divided by a u and if we call this as 3 then we realize that probability of x is equal to expected value of f of x is less than or equal to expected value of x divided by a mu. Okay, so that's a nice and simple proof for the Markov inequality. So the Markov inequality is a nice one because it just a simple one also because it only uses one of the moments of the random variable. Meaning that the mean only is used for the inequality. Now, a slightly better inequality could be the Chebyshev's inequality, which uses the first two moments of the random variable. Right? So, in fact, it can be thought of as an application of the Markov's inequality. So, any questions? So, the Chebyshev's inequality says the following. So if x is a random variable, with the mean of mu and the standard deviation sigma. And the probability that the difference between x and mu exceeds some constant times a sigma is less than or equal to 1 over a squared. Well, many professors, they use this Chebyshev's inequality to determine the cutoff points for the final grades. Right, so how many sigmas are is one student away from the mean, and then based on that, they fix the numbers. Of course, some people use absolute numbers, like, you know, 99% and above will be A, 98 and 99% will be A minus, you know. So,
is that 1 over a squared?
Yeah, 1 over a squared. And we can prove this Chebyshev's inequality from the Markovs very easily by observing the following. Probability that x minus mu is greater than a times sigma is the same as probability that x minus mu to the whole square is greater than a square sigma square. So we are going to take this as the random variable, non-negative random variable. And the expected value of this is what? What is the expected value of x minus mu the whole square? That is the sigma square, right? That's a variance, which is the square of the standard deviation, right? So the expected value of x minus mu the whole square happens to be sigma square. Therefore, we apply the Markov's inequality. So apply Markov's inequality.
Dr. Rao, why, how do you know x minus mu is sigma squared?
That's the definition of the standard, the variance of a random variable. Right, so variance of a random variable is nothing but expected value of x minus mu the whole square.
Okay.
So that's the definition of the variance. And also known as the second moment of the random variable, around the mean. So applying the Markov's inequality. So we know that this expected value is that, so probability x minus mu square is greater than x square. Sigma square is less than equal to the sigma square, that's the expected value of that, divided by a square sigma square. So the Chebyshev uses the first two moments, and therefore it is going to be more accurate than only using the first moment. And the Chernoff bounds, so they utilize all the moments of the random variable. Therefore, they give us a very tight bound. So, and let's define the Chernoff bounds. So we will not prove these, but they are not very difficult to prove either using generating functions. There is a very nice proof for these. So for the Chernoff bounds, we will be focusing on binomial random variables. So in particular, we start with the Bernoulli trial, right? So Bernoulli trial. Has two outcomes. Let's call them success and failure. Or it could be head and a tail, like in a two-sided coin and so on. And then we are given that the probability of a success is equal to some value p. And the probability of failure will be 1 minus p. right? So that is the Bernoulli trial. And we can define a binomial random variable as the sum of n independent Bernoulli trials. Parameters N and P. So we will also denote it as B N P. And P is the total number of successes independent Bernoulli trials. P being the probability of success in one Bernoulli, in each Bernoulli trial. P being the probability of success in the Bernoulli trials. Then here are two bonds that Chernoff was able to prove. So the following are true. So these Chernoff bonds will tell us kind of bounds on the tail ends of this binomial distribution. So how much mass do I have in the tail ends, either on the right side or on the left side? So those are the two bonds we'll be talking about. One is the probability that x is greater than or equal to 1 plus epsilon times np. So remember, the mean of the binomial random variable is n times p. So maybe we'll take a note here, mean of x equals np, and the standard deviation, does anyone remember? Standard deviation of x will be?
Right.
Okay, so that, in the case of a binomial random variable, that happens to be square root of np cube, or np times 1 minus p. So that's the value of the standard deviation. Or the variance is n times p times 1 minus p. So that's true for a binomial random. Okay, so probably that the value of x is greater than the mean by a certain factor epsilon. Probably epsilon could be 0.1 or it could be 0.2, whatever epsilon be like. So it is going to tell us, okay, what is the probability it exceeds the mean by some factor? And it says the following: it's less than or equal to exponential minus epsilon square n p. And it also has another statement for the other end of the distribution, the probability that x is less than or equal to 1 minus epsilon times n p is less than or equal to exponential minus epsilon square n p divided by 2. And what is epsilon? For any epsilon, any constant epsilon, which is in the
open interval 0, 1.
So as this, as these bounds use all the moments of the random variable, they tend to be much more precise than the other bounds. We can illustrate this with a simple example. Say I flip a coin, a two-sided coin, 1,000 times. Oh, okay. Then I may want to ask the question, what is the probability that I see more than 600 heads? And if you use the Markov's inequality, it's going to give us some number. Chebyshev's will give a better number. And Chernoff will give us a much, much better number. So showing that the Chernoff bounds is much, much more powerful than the other two. So maybe we'll do an example next time, but you may want to use these bounds in problem number 2 in the homework. So that's why I'm mentioning these for you to be aware of. So, we will do a quick example next time. And then immediately followed by that, we'll talk about polynomial arithmetic. So in particular, we will consider the complexity of multiplying two polynomials. How fast can we multiply? And that polynomial multiplication has tons of applications. In fact, all the arithmetic logic units that we use in any computer, they're all based on algorithms that would use, polynomial arithmetic. So, for example, if I want to multiply two integers, and the algorithms people use are based on algorithms that one uses for multiplying polynomials. So it's so fundamental. And other than that, there are tons of applications we will also look at. So I think I will stop here. If there are any questions, we'll take them. Okay. It's not symmetric?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we will, I guess one has to go through the proof of the Chernoff bounds. So when we talk about, left side, has that kind of an asymmetry. I mean, I guess it's kind of difficult to explain it. Unless we look at the proof, it will be quite obvious. Okay, any other questions? But asymptotically speaking, it's not going to make a difference, right? Because whether it's a 2 or 3, if you have big O of something, then it may not be. Okay, so any other questions? So if not, we'll stop here. And for the homeworks, please send me an email if you have questions. Or, we can discuss during the office hours also. The 16th is a.
I missed the final term after that.
Home office, yeah. How about Thursday is 1 o'clock? Class. 11. Yeah, 11 is fine. Okay.
I couldn't see. Yeah. Thanks.
Sorry. And then. Okay. So we want to. Okay. Yeah, sure.
And then
so we want to express whatever number it is. We know that it is at most 2 to the power n because it has got at most n bits in it. So what is called factorization of an integer? We will express it as the product of some prime numbers. Because the one of the theorems from Lubomirski says that if you give me any integer, I can always write it as a product of prime numbers.
Yeah.
That's a fundamental theorem in number theory. Probably do if I have 36 icons recognized. 2 times 2 times 3 times 3. So that theorem says for any integer I can always write it as product of these prime numbers. Now in this case it happens to be 2 square times 3 square. But the number of distinct prime numbers is only 2. Okay. Now, I want. Again. So we asked the question,
okay,
how many
you.
Such distinct
yeah.
prime numbers can be there in S?
Hi.
Okay. Every prime number is at least 2.
So is that like a thing like the P and R can be written as this one?
Exactly.
Why it would be 2?
Oh, because we, for example, if I have n bits, so I can think of this as an integer, this being the LSB. The next bit, and so on. So the value of this binary number is one, right? By definition of the binary numbers. Okay, we think of it as a binary number.
So, like, then when we talked about the string matching, we also
think of it as a binary number. So when I said a T sub I only mean the binary number, the integer.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, sure.